place in the heaven. So here we are, lone men in the...
We're in the 46th section today. 46th section. And it starts out with an interesting thing here. The scriptures notwithstanding, notice it says in the second verse, notwithstanding the things which are written, it has always been given to the elders of my church to conduct all meetings as directed and guided by the Holy Spirit. This was an extremely important issue, most right at the beginning of the church, and it has never been settled in the Christian world, as far as that goes, the issue between Amt and Geist, between the office and the Spirit, right from the beginning. To get it over with in a hurry here, just briefly, what the issue is here. The early Christian church, they said, was a brotherhood of spiritually like-minded people that came together. Therefore, they didn't need organization. They didn't need rules. They didn't need officers and things like that. It was just a pure spiritual spontaneity that brought them together. This was the theory of Amt, and this was the predominant theory, especially in the 1880s and following, in all church historians. They said there was no organization in the early Christian church because it was a church of office. Well, on the other, because it was a church of the Spirit. On the other hand, it was a church with apostles and prophets and organizations and rules for admission, initiation, ordinances, all sorts of things. In other words, it was highly organized. But how could you have both? Typical German scholarship, they couldn't realize that you could possibly have both. The two extreme points of view, these have been the magnetic points. The churchmen drawn to the one or the other. The one is the opinion the operation of the Spirit precludes the existence of formal organization. The other, the operation of the church, completely supersedes the Spirit. Why? Because the Spirit is unpredictable. Remember, St. Augustine says, Spirit is wonderful if you have spiritual gifts, but you can't count on them. You can't control them. He actually uses this expression, what we are is authority and inspiration that can be turned on and off like a tap in any degree that we want it, when we want it, and as we want it. If we depend on the Spirit to guide us, he says, we never know what's going to happen. So he went completely the other extreme. Everything turned to office. Office and ordinance took the place of Spirit and revelation. This was a complete change, but naturally they knew it was the discovery of the Didache in the 1880s that enabled Harnack to show, a little later there, that however spiritual a primitive church might have been, it's also highly organized. And so he asked the question, and it should have been natural enough, what in the world is there to prevent a man who holds an office from being directed by the Spirit? And what's to prevent a spiritual man from holding an office, being appointed? In fact, Harnack concluded not only that one holding an office in the church, but also very probably, as far as the ancient church is concerned, you had to do these two. The two had to go together. He says, the power and gifts of the Spirit can be possessed by holding one of the offices of the church. You don't have to hold. There are two statements here very interesting. One is by John Chrysostom, who made a lot of statements on the subject, who was a great bishop. He was the bishop of Caesarea. He was the bishop of Antioch. He was Bishop of Constantinople. He got bounced out of every place because he was much too honest to start telling the people the truth. And then he was invited to go elsewhere. And he finally ends up with the barbarians of Central Asia and has given us one of the best descriptions we have from the early 4th, late 4th and early 5th description of life on the steppes of Asia at that time. That's where you end up if you're too honest as a bishop. And Chrysostom was a Greek one, as his name shows. And the other, St. Augustine. But he says in his time, he says, members of the church are always asking him, everywhere, asking him, what happens, what's ever happened to the spiritual gifts? Why do we no longer have the gift of tongues? Where are the prophets? Why are men not chosen for office as they were anciently by direct revelation from above? And his answer is always the same, a very logical one. He says the church no longer has these gifts because it no longer needs them. He said they were like a supporting scaffold which was taken down as soon as the building was finished. Or like a prop with which a gardener supports a young tree. As soon as the tree becomes strong and vigorous, the prop is taken away because it's no longer needed. Well, of course, neither John Chrysostom nor his hearers were satisfied with that answer. The plain implication was that the Church of the Apostles was weaker than the Church in their time. The Apostles needed this prop. The Church today doesn't need it. Well, they knew that there was something wrong about that. Nevertheless, that remained the official answer. The Church has taken over the offices anciently filled by the Spirit. In fact, it was the Spirit thing. Now, St. Augustine has a lot to say on this subject. I say we can't control it. He says we can't wait for revelation and things like that. We want to be able to demonstrate any time we want to that this is absolutely true. We can't wait for the Spirit to convert people. We can't wait for people to be converted by revelation. We have to have evidence which is as undeniable as that, the way he put it, is that 3 and 4 make 7. When you've got it tied up like that, then you have nothing to worry about. Of course, this is the foundation of scholastic philosophy, and they worked on a purely intellectual ground from there on. But repeatedly he declares that he believes only in what the Church tells him, and only because the Church tells him to believe it. He says it may be paradoxical in a man who himself was prescribing the fundamental theology of the Church. After all, where did the Church get its philosophy? From St. Augustine. And why did St. Augustine believe what he did? He says because the Church teaches it. But this is indeed... In vain you argue, he tells the Pelagians, for though no reason can explore or speech explain it, whatever is believed by the whole Church is true. So we get these two ideas, the Church of the Spirit and the Church of Office. Office took over. You have both. Of course, the Roman Catholic stands for the one in the extreme, especially during the 19th century, made a big thing of the monolithic Church, of course, traditionalism. And the other, at the very same time in the 19th century, the Protestants went to the other extreme. Nothing counts but Spirit. Let's forget organization. Let's forget everything but the Spirit. Well, in one case, the Spirit is completely ineffectual if you don't have organization or pattern to work in. In the other, if you have the organization with the pattern, you have the pattern without the Spirit. No matter how well organized, you may end up with what people fear the world is getting into today. Well, let's get on here now. And you notice, then the rules, never cast anyone out of your public meetings, because you never know. After all, the physician is sent to the sick and not to the well. We cannot judge others. I noticed what was spoken today during the 2.5 minute talks. The idler will be held answerable before me. The Lord says, I will judge the idler. He will. I don't know who he's idling. You can't judge the amount of work another person is engaged in. But I will. He says, I can tell that. The idler shall not be had in remembrance before me. All right, he'll decide that. We won't. And in the same way here, what about people in your public meetings? Who are the good people and who are the bad people? Who should be there and who shouldn't? You have no business trying to decide that, he says. He makes that as a definite rule. They're never to be cast out. In the next verse, all members attend sacrament meeting, though not all partake. This, for years, was the theory of the word missa, the word mass, of course. At a certain point of the early, was argued. Remember, it's a very interesting thing. We have no, from the scriptures we have, or from the early times, we have no record of how they held meetings, of what the liturgy and the protocol was in meetings, how they administered the sacrament, how they baptized. We have nothing. Basil wrote very interestingly on that, one of the great Cappadocians, cousin of his, John Chrysostom. It's a funny thing, he says, we administer the sacrament, we don't know the words that are spoken, he says. We baptize, we don't know what we're supposed to say when we baptize. None of that's been handed down. That's an interesting thing. That's why the liturgy and everything grew up after, and that's why today it's all changing, because now they're discovering the really old record and finally they're doing it all wrong. So you have the Ecumenical Council and make basic changes right from top to bottom. Well, but the idea was that at a certain point of the meeting, those who were not members were asked to leave before the sacrament because they couldn't partake of the sacrament. Well, for the simple reason that you can't renew a covenant you haven't made. But they do always witness unto him, they always remember him, that they keep his commandments, we renew our covenants, and if you haven't made any covenant of baptism, you can't renew it. No point to that. So the missa was the dismissal of the non-members before, but that's not accepted by anyone anymore. Another story. But the whole nature of the early Christian meetings, he's talking about the what you would call liturgy. What you do when you come together in a meeting. So here we are, so what do we do? This is exactly what Mr. Abraham Kaplan says, the
great Hebrew professor, the most illustrious Hebrew professor in this country until he went to Israel. Now he's in Israel. And he was a Hasidic Jew who strictly believed in moral Judaism and in abstract goodness and all this sort of thing. Until recently, he's kind of the other extreme. And now it's the temple, the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem. And he says the people that want to build the temple, the people most involved, the most excited about it, are all the most frightened. They're worried sick because of the problem of who will be in charge when we get it built, and then what do we do when we have it built? Well, because the temple scroll shows that the slaughtering of beasts in the outer court was not the essence of the temple ordinance as we get it in Leviticus. No, it's something else. And now, as I say, the temple scroll, 1976, that's recent enough for you, shows a very different picture of what went on in the temple anciently. But here, the meetings were a mystery. Now, here he's prescribing doing things in meetings and what should be done and so forth. This elsewhere in the doctrine comes. That's the purpose of it. But we don't know whether they were secret or not, or above all, the love feast, the agape, the eros, the guild feast, the mystery and so forth. What about these meals they prepared? There was the agape was a different kind. The sacrament was yet another. What about this partaking of food when they came together? A very significant thing. Every time Christ appears, in which we have any record, after the resurrection, he always eats with the people. It's not just the sacrament, sometimes, but in the Book of Mormon, the same thing. But remember, he cooked fish on the beach for breakfast for the apostles when they were fishing the morning after his resurrection, then invited them to come to fire and eat. A very interesting thing. But the sharing of the meal is a sign of complete sharing. Nevertheless, if any have trespassed, let him not partake until he makes reconciliation of the sacrament. Because the food part is a complete sharing. And if you're out of it for any reason, if you're withdrawn, or have any mental reservations or anything of that kind, well, if the whole purpose is the Yechad, seen the Dead Sea Scroll, the only word they use for the church, the only word they use for the community is Yechad. Means the oneness, the unity. The church is rendered the church usually. And the same thing for confirmation meetings. We have confirmation meetings today. Well, we do that, take care of that as sacrament now. Now, here now, we get the nearest thing in the seventh verse to the once popular idea of the early Christian meeting as a free operation of the Spirit. The meeting itself is charismatic, not just the charisma. Ye are commanded in all things to ask of God who giveth liberally. And that which the Spirit testifies unto you, even so I would that ye should do in all. This will what decide ultimately, what will decide what you do in your meetings. And the Spirit, how you do it. What the Spirit testifies, so I would that you do in all holiness of heart, walking uprightly before me. See, there must be no mental reservation, nothing that special. It's not a matter of form, dutifully dressing up properly and then going to meeting. That's not going to do it at all. You notice it must be with holiness of heart, walking upright before me, not merely impressing your neighbors, or yourself for that matter. Considering the end of your salvation, that's what you have in mind. This is not just a form you go through the nicety of every Sunday. Oh, I should have brought along, and I was going to bring along, a review of a book by a Southern Baptist minister, a biography Billy Graham, right. Imagine forgetting his name. It's very amusing. Extremely. Because he's very frank, very honest. He makes him a very admirable character and so forth. But there's nothing there but surface as far as you can see. Really, you see, because the whole that's what pays off. The main theme this man makes in his biography is the statement, woe unto you when all men speak well of you. He says, all men speak well of Billy Graham. He says, we can't find us any instance in which anybody said anything bad about him. He says, that's something very wrong. He's tuning himself to those people and not to the Lord. But this puts it on this footing, you see. Considering the end of your salvation, doing all things with prayer and thanksgiving, that ye may not be seduced by evil spirits or doctrines of devils or commandments of men, for some are of men and others of devils. Note the danger here of the whole thing going sour so very easily. Why? It could be evil spirits could seduce you. if you let yourself go. See, you open yourself to the spirit, and if you're not playing fair the same way, or the doctrines of devils, or for that matter, the commandments of men, as far as that goes. Who are men to lay down the pattern you're to follow? For some are of men, and some are of devils. And if it's not of God, you don't need to say it's a devilish necessary. Or it's not of man, it's not necessarily evil. There is a spirit in man. Remember, as Paul says, and as the Lord said, what man can understand the spirit of the things of... No man understands the things of man except by the spirit of man, and the spirit of God except by the spirit of God. No man understands the things of God except by the spirit of God. No man understands the things of men except by the spirit of man. And, this is a disturbing item, no man understands the things of Satan. Everybody's sort of becoming authorities on Satan these days, but watch out. No man understands the things of Satan except by the spirit of Satan, which we shouldn't understand at all. Notice, wherefore, here's a warning, beware lest ye are deceived. There's always the danger of being deception here when people get into this spiritual realm. You have to watch it all the time, he says. Beware lest ye are deceived. Well, how do you avoid that? And that ye may not be deceived, seek earnestly the best gifts, always remembering what they are given for. Notice, it's a gift not to be deceived here. Everything comes by the gifts. We must seek for definite gifts of the mind and not be carried away by them, always remembering what they are given for. You notice safety from the uncontrolled guys. That was the danger. See, St. Augustine, all the rest of them saw that. If we turn our meetings over to the Spirit, and this is what had happened in Kirtland. There were some pretty wild parties there. Yeah, they're going out to the Shakers. Well, the Shakers were right next door. And all these sects and so forth, and the Holy Rollers and the rest. And that can get out of hand very easily. And where does it lead? Nowhere. See, it's a deception. So, the safety of uncontrolled spirit. Does it lie in office? No, he says it does not. God does not appoint individuals to put it right. We must have the gifts of discernment for ourselves. The gifts of... A person called me on the phone last night and talked for an hour. He was long, he was very much perturbed because his wife had gone off to some new sect, new offshoot of Mormon. They always get these, you know, and then they always fizzle in time. But he was very much upset about this. And what could he do about it? His wife had these fantastic ideas. Well, that's her affair as far as that goes. But these gifts are individual, special endowments. Now he's going to talk about the gifts. He's not saying, well, in a general sense, it's nice if you have a gift and you won't be led astray. He says specifically, I'll tell you what these gifts are and how they operate. They're not automatically bestowed with office. As Brigham Young says, prophecy is a gift. It's not an office. Many high officers do not have it, and many ordinary people do have it. These gifts, as they're given, the Lord tells us here how they are given with these gifts are to individuals that all may be benefited. Yes, 46, the sixth verse here. Yes. For all have not every gift given unto them. Now don't expect everything, see. For there are many gifts, and to every man is given a gift by the Spirit of God. We started right out at the beginning, where the Lord told Joseph he had a gift for translating for that time. And when he finished translating, that gift would be changed for another, and he would have a great gift of preaching and spreading the gospel. Other gifts would take place. As we need them, the Lord gives us these gifts. They're not always the same. Not every person has the same. Notice how important it is not to judge each other. We don't know what gifts we're under here. But these gifts to individuals are that all may be benefited that seek or ask me. It's not something you hug to your breast or something you can walk off with, as they used to say. This is my gift and something you're very proud of. Nor is it secret. It's to be put at the disposal of all the others. They are, notice, given for the benefit of those who love me and keep all my commandments. We do that, then he says, I'll distribute my gifts among you, and those who have these gifts, don't ask for a sign. To ask for a sign, notice in this ninth verse, to ask for a sign are given for the benefit of those who love me and keep all my commandments, and him that seeks to do so. And they're not signs. Notice they signs follow them that believe. and they're given for them that already believe. Now, the signs were meant for the wicked in the theory of the fourth and the fifth centuries. That's how they were always converted, by miracles, these tremendous miracles that were done. We won't go into that. But they required nothing. A miracle was a sign was a show. You made no sacrifice, you didn't believe, it came before you believed, and it made you believe. It was a miracle so wonderful it twisted your arm and you had to believe, this sort of thing. Well, these signs always follow them that believe, we're told in Mark. But to receive a sign requires no self-control. You have it all your way. As he says in this verse, that you may consume it on your lusts, on your lusts. Everybody wants to see a sign. It's very exciting. We'd love to see a sign. But that has nothing to do with it. If you start asking for a sign, you're in real trouble here, he says. In the legends of the 4th and 5th centuries, I say, the signs are especially boon to the wicked. They do not follow them that believe, but the other way around. They are given unto the church. They are gifts for the general use, it says in the 10th verse here, and there are many of them. Each person receives a gift by the Spirit of God. Then, to some is given one, and to some another. We don't all have the same or follow the same pattern. Away with stereotyped Mormons, Brigham Young says. I don't want stereotyped Mormons. There's no such thing as a typical Mormon or a Mormon type, however much we would like to make it. And they are not to give one person the advantage over another, in the manner of Nimrod, that all may be profited by. Remember, if God gave Nimrod a special gift, the descendant of Ham, grandson of Ham, his mighty bow by which he could defend the human race against the monstrous animals at that time, against which they were very helpless sometimes, because these creatures are really something. But Nimrod quickly made the discovery that by turning this bow against his fellow man, he would put them at his disposal. He was supposed to put his gifts at the disposal of the human race. Instead, I have a gift, so I'll put the human race at my disposal. I'll patent it. If I come out with a good thing or a book or something like that, that should be for everybody. And you shouldn't latch onto it and still keep it while you give it at the same time. You can't do that. Is it moral to patent things? No, it isn't, of course. We won't go into that again. But the thing is, these gifts are mine, but all may be profited thereby. We must share gifts. That's what they're for. And if you don't share them, you don't get them, he says. You have to give them freely. We used to have that song, Gifts of the Little Strings. And it is true. And the more freely you give, the more the stuff keeps pouring in. A person who hoards his ideas and makes a discovery and makes great secrecy of it and won't let anybody see his notes or anything for years until he gets it out, he'll dry up just as sure as anything. You always do. Just be free, let anybody have it. There's more where it came from, and it makes it more interesting that way. We do all know. Now he goes in the 13th verse here. Do we not all know that Jesus Christ is the Son of God and was crucified? Well, that's the Athanasian Creed as far as that goes. All the Christian world says that. People can memorize the creed and they can recite it. Notice the 13th verse is the creed, actually. Know that Jesus Christ is the Son of God and that he was crucified for the sins of the world. But what does it mean? One can speak with formal phrases in testimony meetings, but to have the gift of the Holy Ghost is something else. Is it something you can talk meaningfully about? One wonders if that's even so. These words, incidentally, were the first words that the Lord spoke to Joseph Smith in the grove when he spoke to him. I was crucified, I'm Jesus Christ, I was crucified, and so forth. The Son of God was crucified for the sins of the world. Well, but can you talk meaningfully about it? Yes. Next verse says you should bear your testimony. You really should. Because to others it's given to believe on their words. Somebody will have the gift to believe what you say, what you believe. You can actually transfer it here. Because it's a gift to others to receive, to believe on their word, that they also might have eternal life. Moroni makes that very clear. The 7th chapter of Moroni makes that very clear, how this happens, how this passed down. Now we come in the 15th verse, but how about the important business of administration? To some it's given by the Holy Ghost to know the differences of administration, as it will be pleasing unto the same. The idea with administration, it's necessary, it's essential, it's indispensable. Where is it good? Where should it be applied? And when is it being overdone? The thing we have to watch very carefully, because we can go completely ape on administration if we do up to the BYU. we have now. We have a faculty, largely inactive faculty of 1,000 up there, about 4% of whom are producing something, this figure. But we have an administrative force of 2,600. See, 2.5 times as many administrators as teachers at the Peabody. Everybody has to watch everybody else like that. Well, see, we can go overboard for administration. We do it in our site. And finally, all you do, you have nothing to do but administer. The situation we're in today, what do you do? Administer is like a person who says, in Hollywood, to be a producer, what do? You say, I'm a producer. You may not have a play yet, you may not have a script, you may not have any actors, you may not have a studio or anything, but you're a producer if you say you're a producer. That's what the formula is. To be a producer, you simply say, I am a producer. To be an administrator, you say the same thing. Now, but we don't do without it. Just the same, it's important to organize here. And it's meant administration in the present day sense here. It's always changing, notice, according to the conditions of the children of men. Administration is not by a particular form of administration, a particular mode, a particular organization. It's never rigid and never eternal. It's not a principle, an eternal principle of the gospel. Notice it says it changes according to the conditions of the children. Different conditions require different administration, that's all. Yes, sir.
Is this administration we're talking about here the same thing when in section 129 talks about discerning the differences?
Yes, sir. It talks about discerning the spirits and administration, yes. The thing here is that we have to have them both. You can't do without them, but don't let them get on top of you. Recognize this first of all. You see, we're always going to have the spirit. These things are eternal. But meanwhile, as he said, according to the conditions of the children of men in our human temporal existence here, we need it to apply, what? To changing conditions. They will change, and we have to change them too. So we shouldn't be too upset and demand, a rigid formality as if one particular law or rule was the eternal order of things. The important thing is to know which administration under prevailing conditions is pleasing to the Lord according as the Lord will, suiting His mercies according to the conditions of the children of men. There he places it here very clearly, you see. Now there is this type of administration the Lord wants, and we must find out how He wants us to do it. Notice, as it will be pleasing to the same Lord according as the Lord will. You can sit down in the committee and spend, there's nothing, nothing is time-wasting, it's committees, as you know, and you'll get nowhere. So the main thing is to decide what the Lord wants according as the Lord will, suiting His mercies. He's granted us this thing mercifully according to the conditions of the children of men. So these things go along. And this means a very complicated picture. Administration can be very complicated, and it's a big problem. Look at our administrative, our economic hang-ups today. They get so very complicated. Notice the way it's put here in the next verse? We're just surrounded by diversities of operations. Diversities of operations. All sorts of operations going on around, and diverse means in various sorts of directions, working in various ways. So it's a complicated picture. And the question then is to know whether they be of God, that the manifestations of the Spirit may be given to every man to profit therewith. How we can take advantage of these so we'll use the right ones? It's given by the Holy Ghost to know. That's how you'll know that. How do we judge them? It's very confusing. And yet we must all participate. Our only hope is that the manifestation of the Spirit may be given, notice, to every man to profit withal. You notice there's very little said about leadership in any of these passages on government and administration. Every man has to be gathered, and every president of the churches, and let people so live that they will not when we are guided and so forth. And so we get to another word of wisdom here. Again, unto you it's given by the Spirit of God the word of wisdom. Notice the very next thing. The word of wisdom is where you have a say, where you decide. Notice the God gives us certain commandments, and we don't know why we're supposed to do it. I know not, say the Lord has commanded me. There are others given not by commandment, but by word of wisdom, where you're welcome to discuss, examine, experiment, as happens in the case of the word of wisdom. When you, as President Smith used to say, Joseph Fielding used to say, word of wisdom means using your wisdom, that you're supposed to exercise wisdom here. It's a word of wisdom, not by commandment, using your own judgment. Many commands are given without an explanation. You see, we don't know. But the word of wisdom is open for discussion. We've discovered a lot of things about it. Next, the word of knowledge, because wisdom must have something to work on. See, as we began to understand the word of wisdom better and see why for this and why that, it's because our knowledge increased, our knowledge of diet, food chemistry, and all sorts of things. And the knowledge is necessary for the wisdom to operate on. With an empty head, we can't be wise, in other words. And the wise one profits by experience, which is knowledge. It's all the whole thing. The word of knowledge goes with it. And then faith to be healed. This doesn't require the elders. You can be healed. Remember, it tells us back there in the 40th section, those who have not faith to be healed shall call in the elders and so forth. Some have faith to be healed, and that is a gift, not requiring the elders. And the others is, this is an interesting thing in the 20s. It is not, nobody has the gift to heal. That would be magic. Nobody does. But to have faith to heal, it's faith that heals. You heal by faith. That's another thing. You're not the healer. That would be magic. Speak the magic word, Shazam, or whatever it is. Magic does not work by faith. Magic works by gadgets. We talk about magic drugs, and because the magic of science and so forth. We can't explain what's happened. We say, well, that's the thing itself. Does it just works. But that's not with faith. It's like the Liahona. Liahona wasn't magic. When people stopped exercising faith, it didn't work. A magic Liahona would always work. Like the Seal of Solomon, the Wand of Solomon, or the Book of the Magician, or the Robe of the Magician, or the staff, that the power is in the thing itself. It's in the gadget. Well, that's magic. No, we have no magic here at all. And to others it is given, notice, not the gift of healing, but to have faith to heal. And then, to some is given the work of miracles. All the gifts are miracles, as far as that goes. But these are unclassified, as may be necessary from time to time. Miracle is something miraculous, something you can't explain, is what happens. To others to prophesy. See, we're not all prophets, but others have it. Not just one person in the church. There's more than one prophet. Here, prophecy, again, you see, is plainly a gift, and not an office. And then, the gift of discerning spirits. Now, this is one that's very interesting, like this man that called last night and was so upset about his wife and so forth. Well, the spirits, that they get this all the time now, everywhere. Well, look, now it's always been in the church. This is Kirtland, where they needed this very badly. So, everybody was getting spirits of all sorts, and they had to be discerned. The gift of discerning of spirits, one of the greatest gifts. With the fall, we see we became spiritually dead, but it doesn't mean that we have to remain so. We can see things going on in the spirit world, but that is a gift to some people. And to some to speak with tongues, glossolalia. The Episcopal Church in the 1950s, 60s got all excited about glossolalia, speaking in tongues. They formed societies to practice speaking in tongues. They had to join a club. So we can come together on Tuesday night and speak in tongues. The Church of England, of all things, has became very popular, this glossolalia. Well, what good is it that Paul says, if I speak in tongues all day long, nobody understands me. That doesn't make any difference. It's the interpretation of tongues. Now, my father had the gift of tongues the day he arrived in Holland to be a missionary. Now, Dutch is no harder than German as far as the grammar is concerned, but the pronunciation is fantastic. Nobody but a Hollander. Of course, this was north of Holland, way from the North Pole, where they have a guttural that you just cannot conceive. I mean, it just tears the soul out of anyone who tries to pronounce those words. And he instantly mastered that completely as soon as he got it. Just by the gift of tongues, he prayed for it and got it. And when Queen Wilhelmina, years ago, a little kid, visited Portland, Dad went and talked to her, and she said that she was the first non-Hollander she'd ever met in her life who spoke Dutch with a perfect accent. Never lost that perfect accent. And the same thing, my mother tells the story of my grandmother down at Manti, when they had the first meeting house down there, and the men were all out working in the fields, and they'd gone up for timber, some of them, and they were having a relief society meeting, and it was Wasikey, I think, some big chief came down, three or four Indians came down, and were listening outside the window. They were going to have a raid on the place. And the sister in charge began to speak in tongues, and she spoke on and on and on, and what's going on here. While outside, these Indians were listening, she was giving them the Book of Mormon straight in this in Paiute language. She was speaking in tongues. She couldn't speak a word of it. But she gave this marvelous discourse, and then the door banged open, and they stopped in. These noble red men, and with tears streaming down their faces, what they had heard. Well, there's a gift of tongues that's useful, that sort of thing. but really for a display. Now, you notice, the gift of tongues without the interpretation of tongues is a waste of time. I can babble away. I can invent a tongue as far as that goes. And that would be very much like some of our people in the religion department. We try to learn biblical languages. If we didn't have a pony in our hand all the time, good old King James is right there all the time, they'd never get first base. There are other texts to be read. But you have to have the interpretation of the message when it's necessary. Joseph needed it badly. He had to have the gift of tongues for when he translated John, when he translated the papyri, when he translated other things, and of course the Book of Mormon. Nobody knew so. But notice it tells us the 25th verse here. Well, first, as we're passing, none of these gifts is something to walk off with, I say. It's nothing a personal property. None of these is a cause for self-congratulation. Joseph Smith never mentioned, even casually, his great accomplishments in translation as a personal attainment, as a talent of his. It wasn't, of course. He was merely an instrument. But a gift is a gift. Notice, you couldn't boast about it. It's something you haven't earned. You haven't made it for yourself. It's not a reward or something you've earned. If it was, you could demand it as your right. It wouldn't be a gift at all in that case. But you can't demand a gift of anyone, and you can't demand a gift of God. You can't say, I worked for this, now you've got to give it to me. No, that's pay. That's hiring salary, as Ella says. That's not a gift. And you can't demand, nor have you a right to your gifts from others when God commands you to share, to withhold your gift from others when God commands you to share. Condition on which he gives them something. All these gifts, the 26th verse says, come from God for the benefit of the children of God. It's not just to show, they're not meant as signs and wonders. They're to be, they're useful and not for boasting. How far this all is from our philosophy of success, your right, your possession, your earnings, your achievement, acquisition, getting ahead and so forth. Totally different world we're in here. At last, in the 27th verse, a gift does go with an office. Definitely, here you see. The bishop and other elders, as God shall appoint and ordain to watch over the church, are to have it given to them to discern all those gifts. They will, because they have to deal with all these people and so forth. And this is a very important thing. And this, in the end, is the church to discern these gifts and so forth. And you have no idea. I suppose you have, as much as I do, but I get all sorts of nuts because I'm sort of enough myself, I attract it. And no, but I mean in mail, phone calls, visits all day long, it drives you wild. The church just swarms with crackpots. We're in the midst of a beehive of nuts here. There is an odd mixed metaphor, isn't it? It's true. And the funny thing is that it hasn't torn the church apart ages ago. Because it's always been that bad. This is not something new that just come on us with the stress of the times. The church has always been full of crackpots. But nobody has ever gainsaid them. Nobody has ever had to crack down on them this way. They've gone their own ways and so forth. It has not been necessary to denounce. Usually they form their splinter groups and the like. And in no time they just sort of vanish. Frank Denning was a fine man. I knew him quite well. But what happened to his order there? Everybody was so worried about it. There's nothing to worry about at all. These things come and go. And there are hundreds of them. Have been. But here, the discernment, the main power for the authorities in the church is to discern these very things. If they discern, then everything's going to be all right. They won't be taken in. To avoid the inevitable chaos and confusion, where all are free to claim gifts and many are eager to do so. Now, anyone is free to ask for a gift. Notice the next verse, the 28th. Anybody's to ask. And he that asketh in the Spirit shall receive, but you have to ask in the Spirit, remember. With real intent and honestly, not for any personal ambition or ulterior motive. Can you ask for all of the gifts? What about that? What if you want to ask for all of them while you're really going to town in the 29th verse? Well, if your sole purpose is in order that every member may be profited thereby, well, can you aspire to be head of the church for the good of others? A lot of people have. And John Bennett on, the Lord needs me to be the head of the church because for the good. It's not for my own interest or anything like that, but it's necessary for the advancement of the church. Lots of people have taken that magnanimous position. John C. Bennett did, Simon Magus did. That's exactly what Simon Magus claimed in the famous debates with Peter.
But this makes it clear there's no problem there because God is the head. You see, he is doing it here. Sure. And under some it may be given to have all those gifts, that there may be a head, in order that every member may profit thereby. He that asks in the Spirit according to the will of God, wherefore it is done even as he asks. So he is the head. Permit him to do it his way. And there's no danger here because it says in the 30th verse, you must ask according to the will of God. There it is, right? It is the will of God, not your own. In the name of Christ, next verse, and always in the Spirit, and you must give thanks to God in the Spirit. Notice you give thanks for gifts. They are free gifts. And we must recognize them as such. Give thanks to him in the Spirit, and nothing will work. And here is the rub here. Flesh. Nothing will work unless you practice virtue and holiness before me continually. And if you do that, if you actually practice virtue and holiness continually, nothing could go wrong. Nothing could possibly go wrong. If you practice virtue and holiness continually, needless to say, things go wrong because we don't. Well, this is a very instructive section then on the Spirit and the office in the church and the relationship between them. That was the second bell, wasn't it?
No.
Was it?
First.
Oh, well, go on. The next is a very short one, 47. John Whitmer becomes church historian. Now, setting up a definite office. There's a good example of administration. Church historian. A lot of people know lots of stories and often contribute substantially to history. But there has to be one person to collect it all together and coordinate it. And that's what general authorities do. They coordinate the activities of the church. They don't perform all those activities. They can't. They don't do all those things. They just coordinate the activities of the church. They don't interpret the scriptures. They don't tell us what we're to believe and what we're not to believe. Everyone's supposed to know that for himself. We've been told that many times here. Now, John Whitmer, church historian, a very sensible arrangement. But it's not to curtail his activities as an elder, tells the next verse. He's still an elder and still to act as an elder like any other church member, but he has a special assignment. It's the way it should be. Now, what things to record? How do you know which things you'll keep? You know what a church, what a history is. You start writing one thing, and you start writing one little thing. I'm going through in my office piles of things that I've thrown aside in this process. I started to write on one very minor matter, why Abraham was sitting on Pharaoh's throne, and I have thousands and thousands of pages on it, references. I have tens of thousands of references. Terrific, absolutely. But that's the way records accumulate. As soon as you start following something up, there's no art to accumulating notes. I mean, what are you going to do to keep the church historian from being absolutely swamped? Eugene Bolton, Herbert Eugene Bolton, who for years and years was head of the history department at Berkeley, you know, in charge of the history library. He was the great authority on Western history. He stood in front of the collection. We used to have in the top floor of the church office building, the old church office building on South Temple there, all the records of the church St. Joseph Smith were bound in files and set up on shelves all along the wall, right beginning from Joseph Smith right down to the present day. That was the history of the church. It was massive, it was complete, but it wasn't redundant. It could have gone into 20 rooms like that. And Bolton said he knows of no collection anywhere in the world that could even compare to that for both the completeness and the control, the insight. The necessary things are there, nothing that is not necessary is there. It is far more complete, he said, than any other organization, national or other history in existence, and at the same time, it is far more comprehensive and understandable than any other. It was a remarkable thing, because it tells us how that was to be done here, when he says that in the third verse, how he was to do it, yes. You shall appoint unto keep the church record history continually for Oliver County. I have appointed to another office. He has to keep it running. You see, it's been kept running continually. And then comes what things are to be given. It shall be given him, inasmuch as he's faithful, by the Comforter to write these things. He'll know what to write. The Comforter, there's the Spirit again. Well, there's another gift. It will be given to him what he shall write and what he won't write. Otherwise, he could just sit there writing the rest of his days, like Monsieur Pigeonot. In the story of Anatole France, Bishop Pigeonot was going to write a history of the French Navy. There's a classical example, you see. Bishop Pigeonot labored all his life on the history of the French Navy. The papers piled up around his office, and the books piled up around his office, and the notes piled up around his office. Finally, he took a deep breath and he was ready to write his history of the French Navy, and he took a nice brush feather and started to sharpen it and sneezed as he did it, and the paper started to slide and he was suffocated and perished in the ruins.
That's what can happen. So it's very necessary. Every touch here.